in the corner.
Yeah. This is one coming.
Okay.
Is that good for you?
Thank you.
I love doing that. The Public Safety Budget Division will come to order. It is Wednesday, March 26th, because it says so on this piece of paper. Let me apologize to everyone who's been waiting and waiting and waiting for us to get started. We were involved in another meeting, and as happens around here, no conversation was brief. So we will try to work with as much haste as appropriate. And once again, I apologize that we weren't able to get started when you all thought we were going to. It's education. Man, they can wait. That's my theory. The first bill up today is Senate File 3608, Senator Moi.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for hearing Senate File 3608. Senate File 3608 is a pretty small bill. It reinstates a 36-month mandatory minimum for subsequent criminal sexual conduct offenses, which was repealed in 2005. The provision was repealed when the legislature created life sentences for some sex offenders and recodified the existing sentencing enhancement statutes for sex offenders. The language bill basically says that the court may stay the execution of the sentence if it finds that the offender may respond to long-term inpatient treatment. And if the court does order the stay of execution of the sentence, then the court will enter the following conditions as a condition of probation, that the individual remains in incarceration in a local jail or workhouse, and a requirement that the offender successfully completes treatment and aftercare. Madam Chair, that's the gist of the bill. There's a technical amendment that counsel has drafted. The idea here is to apply the mandatory minimum to offenders sentenced for the first through the fourth degree criminal sexual conduct offenses if they have a conviction in the previous 15 years. And so what we would like is in the previous 15 years for the first through the fourth degree criminal sexual conduct offense. And what the A2 amendment does, Madam Chair, is to make it explicitly clear that the mandatory minimum does not, the 36-month mandatory minimum does not apply to fifth degree. And I believe that Mr. Backus has drafted the A2 amendment to take care of that intent.
Okay, any questions on the A2 amendment? If not, all in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have Ann Wall from the Sentencing Guideline, as well as Donna Dunn, who is the Executive Director from MCASA, here to answer questions if members have any questions on the bill.
Okay. Any questions on Senate File 3608?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Okay. Senator Moi moves Senate File 3608 as amended. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I saw Senator Berglund a minute ago. Is Senator Erickson Ropes here? Could somebody walk out in the door and tell Senator Berglund? Thank you. I see you right out there.
Pretty short.
You ready to go?
Done with that one.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry I didn't meet your meeting.
Did you saw anything? Sounds like you're in better health.
Okay. Yeah.
Whenever you're ready, Senator Berglund.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the division,
The reason that this bill has come to this particular division is because I had a silly idea that we could maybe save some money in our system by having people who were in prison, who are likely to be referred for commitment, stay in prison and complete their sex offender treatment if they were in the middle of it.
Senator Berglund, would you pull the microphone close to you, please? Thank you.
And it probably would save us money, but the problem is that while the prison population is forecasted, the sex offender population is not. So the future savings that we would have are not actually available to be recouped in the budget at this point in time. So my intent is to delete that portion of the bill. The rest of the bill really doesn't deal with this division, but I will explain it to you anyway because I'm here.
Senator Berglund, do you have an amendment that you want us to adopt to put it in the form you'd like?
Yes, I do. I'm just trying to figure out which one it is.
Mr. Backus, can you help?
Madam Chair, members, the A-12, Senator Berglund, is your delete everything amendment, but we'll have to orally amend it if you intend to take out those correctional pieces, and I can do that in a few minutes.
Yes, I do intend to take them out.
Okay, if we can have that amendment.
Originally, we were trying to see if I could accommodate Senator Higgins with a bill that she has that has a similar purpose, only at the local level, and that bill has not been through the policy committee, so I don't intend to offer that amendment at this time. So I would move the A-12 amendment, and I would ask Mr. Backus to help us figure out what should come out of it.
Okay, Senator Berglund, Mr. Backus suggests that we adopt the amendment, and then we'll come back to the pieces that you want to adopt as, and we'll give him a chance to make sure and double-check which pieces are in and out.
All right.
Okay. So Senator Berglund moves the A-12 amendment. Any questions? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Senator Berglund.
While he's working on that, then, I have another amendment. It's an A-14 amendment.
Get that handed out as well. Thank you.
Thanks.
Looks like everybody has it now.
Madam Chair, this amendment would have a group of people come together to look at the licensing of our Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Today, it operates under a community-based facility licensing provision. And the thought is that if we can create a license similar to the kind of license they have for the facilities in Wisconsin, we could reduce the cost of the facility. This group would look at that issue and bring some conclusions back next year.
Okay, questions on the A-14 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Berglund moves the A-14 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Senator Berglund.
We have an A-13 amendment.
it looks like everybody has it now. Senator Berglin.
This amends the definition of vulnerable adult to make it possible for people who are on hold orders or who are in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program to not be considered vulnerable adults. And this will reduce a lot of the paperwork that we have going on in the programs now when someone's under a hold order.
Okay. Questions on the A-13? If not, Senator Berglin moves the A-13. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Senator Berger.
Then I have an A-15 amendment.
I'm busy in the amendment department here.
Well, people have done a lot of thinking about this, and I'm so glad that the work we did this summer, Madam Chair, on our informal working group has not gone totally to waste.
That's true. Okay, it looks like everybody has a copy of the amendment.
The bill as it came to you, Madam Chair, removes the special review panel from the process of deciding whether someone should go to the courts to determine whether they are ready to be released from the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And these are technical amendments to that portion of the bill. The counties in that process wanted to gain additional information, and we're just making sure when they do that, they pay to get that information. And other technical amendments to that section of the bill.
Okay. Questions on this amendment? Not. Senator Berglin moves the A-15 amendment. All in favor? All in favor, please say aye. Aye. Okay. Opposed? Adopted.
Madam Chair, maybe we could return to the A-12 amendment and we could figure out what we need to do.
Okay. Mr. Back.
Madam Chair, members, if Senator Berglin's intent is to delete those portions of her bill relating to incarcerating people on hold for civil commitment, you would want to then delete sections 1 to 4 and 8 and 9 from the A-12 amendment.
So I would make that motion.
1 through 4 and what?
1 through 4 and section 8 and 9 as well.
All right. On that motion, Senator Berglin has made. Any questions? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. Senator Berglin, what's left?
Madam Chair, what we have left is a provision that we will study the licensing of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. We have a provision that removes the Special Review Board from the process of kind of a step before everything goes to the courts, and everything goes to the courts anyway, so we're removing that step. And then we are removing hold orders and sex offenders from the definition of vulnerable adult.
Okay. Members, any questions? Is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify on Senator Berglin's bill? Is Mr. Carlson here? Him signed up to testify? I don't see him. That's all. All right.
Madam Chair, then I would move that Senate File 3259 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay.
It would be my intention to try to incorporate this into the Health and Human Services portion, since all of it now deals with the Department of Human Services, into the omnibus appropriations bill, and we're meeting to do that at 6 o'clock, so this just goes back to finance, then we'd be able to do that.
Senator Berglin has everything that relates to corrections, which is in this division, has now been taken out of this bill. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I see Mr. Carlson just arrived, so maybe he has some comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have some handouts here.
Okay. We'll get them passed out.
So you know that
I understand that. It's all right. That's we were repping. Okay.
Mr. Carlson, whenever you're ready, just go ahead.
Madam Chair, maybe while these are being passed out, I can start on my
sure.
comments. I am here in support of Senate File 3259. I'm sorry, I am Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Just a very quick, brief background on county's role in the civil commitment of sex offenders. Counties are responsible for the entire front end of the civil commitment process. The county attorneys prosecute the petitions. In the smaller counties, the attorney general does provide assistance, but the larger ones, it's 100% county staffed and county funded. And because of policy changes that have been made since the abduction and murder of Drew Shadeen, we have seen those costs rise substantially. You'll turn to the handout. The first page on there shows the changes in the level of referrals that have occurred since 2003. Prior to that time, we received a relative handful. Since 2003, we've seen anywhere from 145 to 230 offenders being referred to us each year. Corresponding with those referrals, we've seen our costs for the judicial hold of those offenders while the petitions are being processed go up nearly 11 and a half times, from about $460,000 in 2003 to $5.3 million last year. Just a few other items that I want to cover. In terms of admits, most of those individuals are not the individuals who are being committed. It is the individuals who are being held pending the determination of the commitment petition. So we believe that the Department of Human Services will enjoy at least some breathing room from the rapid increases in cost and bed space that they've had to deal with over the past several years. The final thing I want to note is on the back page. I think perhaps some of the members of the committee are under the misimpression that some recent legislation have provided relief for the counties in terms of our process and how much time we have to deal with these individuals before we have to start picking up the tab for their hold cost. The first of those provisions is the requirement that 1 year notice be provided when the Department of Correction refers those to the county attorneys for civil commitment. Through frankly no fault of the Department of Corrections, the reality is that we're getting 1 year notice in less than half the time. In 2006, for example, of the 65 individuals who were actually referred and then petitioned for commitment in that year, only 21 of those did we receive 1 year's notice. The primary reason why we're not getting that 1 year notice is the phenomena that I refer to as short timers, individuals who are just in DOC custody for such a short time, roughly 14 months or less, that they simply don't fit into that 1 year notice cycle. So, again, it's not the department's fault, but it's just the reality that we're not getting 1 year's notice and sufficient time to process the petition before they get out of prison. The other change that you made more recently is the requirement that we, as counties, the county attorney's office, initiate the petition within 120 days of receiving the referral, if that is our decision. Filing of the petition is only the start of the civil commitment process. Subsequent to the filing of that petition, at least one, usually two, evaluations occur of that individual. There are several hearings that take up to 8 months frequently. So neither of those changes have addressed those changes or the cost issues, the workload that it has been placed on us since the policy of change that occurred in 2003. The legislation that Senator Berglund has before you and the amendment that I believe she will be proposing will provide some potential relief for us and, frankly, in our opinion, will also provide some at least breathing room for DHS, who is bringing 400 new beds online for housing sex offenders this year. And if things don't change, we'll have to bring another 400 beds online in just a matter of a couple years. This will provide some breathing room, and we look forward to the committee's favorable disposition towards that. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any questions?
So, Madam Chair, this portion of the amendment that was deleted could be offered on the floor of the Senate, or it could be offered along the way, but at this point in time, it will derail this bill and the other parts of it. So it's not that I'm not supporting Mr. Carlson's proposal here. It's just a matter of practicality. I can't get my bill pulled out of finance back into a policy committee at this stage.
Thank you. Senator Berglund, I have a question on the working group.
Mm-hmm.
You don't specify any people to be on it or who's to, I guess you say that the Commissioner of Human Services will convene it. Who's going to decide who's going to be on this working group? Would it have people like the Attorney General's office, the county attorneys, MICA? Is it up to them to submit their interest to the commissioner, or how do you envision this working?
Well, I think we'll do similar to what we did with the informal working group we had with the legislature. We will solicit people are interested mm-hmm. to participate from the legislature, and they will bring people from the administration side, and we would look to the Attorney General's office for any legal advice that we might need, but we don't think they need to actually sit on the working
group. Okay. Although they are kind of an important player in this whole process, I suspect, so they may want to.
Well, if they want to, I'm sure they would be welcome. I think it's just a matter of whether they want to. A lot of this is looking at, you know, licensing issues.
Yeah.
And it doesn't involve really a legal opinion. It just, you know, it's just looking at what are required under the current licensing standards for this to be licensed as a community-based treatment facility. And looking at that in comparison to what other states are doing with their licensing requirements for sex offender programs. And, you know, Attorney General may not want to have someone from their staff just sit through all of that.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Mr. Carlson. Can you give me an idea what each individual case is costing? Is that easier to break down by just looking at it here for me?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, for those individuals that are being held currently at Moose Lake or St. Peter, in 2007 the cost was $368 per day. The language that was deleted for those who elected to stay in DOC facilities would have reduced that cost to $88 a day. So we're frankly quite disappointed.
And Mr. Carlson, that is a cost that the counties pay to?
Madam Chair, under current practices, the counties pay 100% of those costs. There is statute that provides the state will pick up to 50% of that, up to the amount of any appropriation, and that appropriation has not been made for a number of years.
And do the counties, Mr. Carlson, pay this directly to DOC, or does it just go in the general fund? Or
No.
Where does it go, Senator Berglund?
Well, it goes in the general fund, but it's paid to the Department of Human Services.
Oh, to Human Services, of course. I keep forgetting that split. Senator Ingebrigtsen, anything else? Any other questions on this bill? Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to testify? got. Senator Berglund moves Senate File 3259 as amended, be recommended to pass. And it'll go back to Finance and then back to your division. On that motion, any more discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Thank you. Senator Erickson Rose.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thanks for coming to our committee.
Yes, thank you. I have Senate File 3294, which is a minor correction on the flood appropriation bill from this summer. As you might imagine, once you have a disaster, there's lots of money and funding flowing in from the state and from the federal and from all sorts of different departments. And sometimes we get double payments, and it gets a little confusing on the ground, you know, people trying to figure out which appropriation to use for which project. So I have Mr. Kerr here. This is just a sort of a technical amendment or a clarification from the department, and I'll let Mr. Kerr walk you through that if you need some further explanation.
Great. Mr. Kerr, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the division. My name is John Kerr. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Homeland Security and the Department of Public Safety. Madam Chair, members, the purpose of this bill is to, as Senator Ropes just indicated, is to amend last year's disaster relief legislation by adding identical language to Section 2 and Section 4 of Article 1 of disaster relief legislation. And the purpose of the amendment and of the language to be added is really to ensure that that legislation is in conformance with the requirements of and the administration of the FEMA Public Assistance Program, and also to ensure that language in that disaster relief legislation is in conformance with Senate File 2607, which is the natural disaster assistance legislation which Senator Rest is the chief author. Very briefly, Madam Chair and members, the language to be added deals with the FEMA Public Assistance Program, and that program provides 75% of the eligible cost of certain disaster work, and it provides that some other entity, whether it be the applicant, in this case local governments, or the state, or some combination thereof, assume responsibility for the remaining 25%. As it happens in Minnesota, our agency is responsible for dispersing the FEMA 75% share and the state matching share. As you recall, last year, the determined that the state would assume responsibility for the full 25% non-federal share, non-FEMA share. So our agency disperses the 75% FEMA share, full 25% state share, the eligible public assistance program costs for local governments. The language that would be added is really intended to protect local governments and state agencies two ways. First of all, it's intended to make it clear that those local governments and those state agencies are entitled to receive both federal money and state matching money for their FEMA-eligible disaster work. Previous, in Subdivision 2 of Section 2, Paragraph A and Paragraph B suggest or actually make it pretty clear that if a state agency or a local government is receiving state disaster assistance money through the legislation, also receives federal government monies, it's required to reimburse the state up to the amount of the federal assistance that it received. That language is very appropriate for other types of federal programs, but doesn't fit the FEMA Public Assistance Program. as I've indicated, that program is a 75% FEMA, 25% non-FEMA program. So the language that we're adding, as I say, would make it clear that state agencies and local governments are entitled to get federal assistance, FEMA assistance, but also get and retain the state matching monies. On the other side of the coin, because our agency, as I've indicated, is dispersing, in effect, 100% of the costs of the eligible disaster work to local governments and to state agencies, if any other state agency were to provide assistance for the same eligible work, that would constitute a duplication of benefits from FEMA's standpoint. And FEMA would probably, during an audit, would probably require that local government or state agency to return a portion of the FEMA assistance. So it's really, as I say, the bill is intended to protect local governments and state agencies from having to return any money to the state and also from having to return any FEMA money to FEMA. I know it's a little confusing between the 75% and the 25%. Certainly be happy to try to clarify that if you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr. Questions? Senator Erickson, so how is this all working down in your part of the world?
Well, it's going well in some places, and other places are still struggling. My three counties, it's been described as people saying, if you know what happened in Houston County, you know what happened in one county. So it's different in every single county. But the money coming from the state and the feds has trickled in. People are still recovering. It's going to be a long recovery process. I'll just say some areas are working and others are a little bit more slow. This particular clarification, if I'm understanding it right, Mr. Kerr, would be, for example, if a local county went ahead and got FEMA monies to help with restoring county township roads. They used the FEMA money, repaired the road, and then it turns out qualified additionally for state money for that same project that they couldn't double dip, as it were, and they'd have to either return any excess money back to the state or excess expenses that were given to them by FEMA. It's kind of wonky language, but it really makes sense.
Okay.
I don't know if you'd agree with that, Mr. Kerr, or not.
Well, no, I think Senator Erickson Ropes has essentially correct. It's a matter of we are providing the FEMA share of eligible local public assistance program costs, and we're also providing the 25% state match to those local governments and state agencies. So if another state agency were to also provide money for the same eligible costs, those are the monies that would need to be returned to the state.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerr, do the counties still, I guess that's not the right answer question. Does the county get an administrative fee? These dollars, is that still an optional thing as it was in the past, or how does that handle for administering?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, they do. There is an administrative cost allowance fee that the federal government provides in addition to the funds for the actual repair and replacement of the damage.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, so I understand that the funds here are used to rebuild infrastructure only, right? These are not funds. These kind of funds don't go to compensate any individuals who are injured in the course of the flooding or lost lives or anything like that.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, you're correct. This is public infrastructure.
Any other questions? If not, Senator Latz moves. That Senate File 3294 be recommended to pass, and it goes to Big Finance. I'm sure there's a better name to call it than that, but Big Finance. On that motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, I have Senate File 2790.
Go ahead, Senator Higgins.
We are working off the second engrossment. This is a bill that was put together as a result of the working group on reentry that our omnibus bill established last year. And you will see in your packet the fiscal note, the summary, second engrossment. So you can see the fiscal note is a real doozy. And so the first amendment I'd like to offer is the A4 amendment. Is that correct? To delete some sections that we just...
Senator Higgins, we were just handed out the A9 amendment.
Say it again.
We were just handed out the A9.
The A9, okay. It's the A9 then. Mr. Backus, is that right?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, the A9 deletes Section 1, which was a provision that would defer prosecution for some first-time drug offenders, and it inserts this issue as a study item for the Controlled Substance Working Group. The changes a reporting date. From December 1st, 08 to March 1st, 09 for the DOC's revocation internal review. It specifies that members of the controlled substance group should be somebody from Minneapolis, somebody from St. Paul, somebody from rural Minnesota, and somebody from the suburbs. This was done to avoid a buildup of everybody from one area of the state. It deletes Section 9, which was a reentry facilities study. It deletes Section 10, which is the provision I really kind of liked, unfortunately, setting up a task force to look at whether we should establish a reentry court. And it deletes Section 11, which was a repealer for the release of nonviolent drug offenders from prison, and inserts this issue as a study item for the Controlled Substance Working Group. I offer that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins, did I understand you to say these are primarily for the purpose of getting rid of the fiscal parts of the bill, or it sounds like there might be some other policy things in here that might have?
Mr. Chair, it doesn't totally eliminate all the cost of the bill, and it changes some things from a requirement to do them to a requirement to study them and some of those kinds of things. This does not totally eliminate the cost of it, and I have another amendment that we will be talking about dealing with other parts of the fiscal note.
Senator Higgins, I know I've tried to follow your summary here, some of the policy provisions that were removed. Is there a way to for you or for staff to tell us what the fiscal impact of each of those proposed deletions was? If there's some that were zero? I'm looking in particular at the...
Senator DeLass, I can't hear you. I don't know quite why, but...
Maybe I'm sitting between mics. Maybe.
That could be it.
Which mic is mine? Is there a way for staff to tell us if there are any of the sections that you're proposing to delete that, if left in, would still have a zero fiscal impact or cost? I mean, I'm looking in particular at the one section which I really liked, which was the deferring prosecution for the first-time drug offenders. And I'm having a hard time believing that that would... actually cost money as opposed to save money in the system as a whole anyway. But I mean, presumably these provisions have all been through judiciary as a policy matter and received support there and through state and local government, or local government operations and oversight, and received support there. So I wonder if there's a way to pick out the provisions that may or may not have no fiscal impact anyway. I know the concern is we don't have any money to spend, but if we can save some policy provisions, it would be nice to try to do that.
Mr. Turner, or maybe Ms. Seufert?
No.
Mr. Turner?
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Mr. Turner.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members. That's Section 1 of the bill, correct?
Yes.
For the Department of Corrections, they state that there would be no bed impact for that. There's no cost to that, obviously, and it seems to make sense, correct? The cost for that comes from the Department of Public Safety, which says that an additional 9,760 records will have to be processed at the BCA on an annual basis. Process includes modifying the criminal history record to reflect that the information is sealed, notifying the appropriate agency and the FBI. And that, in combination with Section 6, which is the Certificate of Good Conduct, which is still in the bill, the programming costs for that, between the two of them, they've combined them. Staff costs are $157,000, and programming costs are $105,000 for $262,000 cost. And, you know, it looks like I think the majority of that would be for the Certificate of Good Conduct rather than the conditional release. But DPS does mention Section 1 having a cost.
Senator Higgins, I don't know if we can even split that out further. And try to hang on to as much of your policy bill as possible here. If it's a question of the notice of expungement or a certificate of good conduct causing all sorts of records processing at the BCA, then that might be a way. I suspect if individuals were given diversion, they might still prefer to avoid a conviction and have a second chance, even if the records weren't deleted or sealed relating to the arrest. Obviously, they prefer to have both, and I think give people a chance of continuing to get decent jobs would be beneficial. But is there a way to split this out? I don't want to pick through your bill line by line on this. But
I'm sorry. There it is. This thing has been whining, and I can't hear it. I can't hear anything but it. Maybe Mr. Backus can help us figure out how to put the Section 1 back in, because I see the amendment didn't. Oh, you know, the section. The amendment does just say delete Section 1 in that piece. So,
yeah.
So if it's possible to put that in, is there any other companion language that needs to go with that?
Mr. Chair and members, there would be some changes to the title amendments later on in the amendment, but that's something we could work out later. The main thing, if you wanted to do that, if you want to reinsert Section 1, you would just delete line 1.2 from your amendment.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I think I'll do that at this point. If it does not have a cost, then let's see about leaving it back in there.
Then we'll work
on the other pieces as Mr. Turner or Mr. Backus gets them figured out.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Mr. Turner.
The cost in Section 1 is not broken out here, but I can talk to the Department of Public Safety. I don't think it would be excessive.
I think that's kind of the conversation that might be going on right over there as well. So why don't we hold off on that until they figure it out in their conversation over there. We can always take it out after we adopt the amendment, I believe. because then it becomes part of the bill.
Senator Higgins, were there any other such provisions that you think might also benefit from the same kind of review at this time?
I should note, Mr. Chair, that Section 11, which is the repealer language, effective next biennium, the provision for early release of nonviolent drug offenders from prison goes into effect, and we wanted to delete that repealer here. That does have a fiscal cost, so I believe we're going to try to include it as a study item for the Controlled Substance Working Group. And we do have a year to spare on that, so we can do that. But that is one piece that I think we had some agreement that it was working well, but it doesn't go into effect for at more than a year out. So we can study that this interim and then deal with it in the next session. Pretty much everything else we deleted had comments in the fiscal note on it. So I believe everything else is does have a cost to it, if I understood the fiscal note correctly.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a description here someplace of where I can find what a non-violent drug offender means? Or do I just assume that, or is it defined in statute here someplace?
I think Mr. Backus is looking that up.
If you can move
while Mr. Backus is looking that up, are there any other questions about the A9 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Could Senator Higgins, could you explain Section 1 again? Exactly what does that mean? To me, it looks just a little controversial. Part that
it's been so long since I thought about it. Section 1 requires the courts, which is a change. Right now the language is may, we're changing it to shall. Requiring the courts to either defer prosecution for certain first-time low-level drug possession offenders, not dealers, but possession, or to enter a written finding that states their reasons why they are they believe that deferral is not appropriate. And currently, courts have the discretion regarding deferral of prosecution and don't need to defend their decision to deny it. This would, have a mechanism now so that the courts would have to say why this person is inappropriate for or this person's actions are inappropriate for deferring the first-time offenders, the low-level nonviolent possession offenders. And it also, Section 1 also authorizes the courts to extend a second chance at diversion to some of these folks as well. This really fits in with the whole philosophy of the reentry working group that we were trying to figure out ways either to keep people from getting something on their record that would haunt them the rest of their lives and make them unable to get a decent job, decent housing, and kind of move forward from an event like this. you know, these very clearly are the first-time offenders. If the, you know, if it is seen that the violation was such that it would be a good likelihood that there would not be a second reoffense, then we've seen it over the years that it is sometimes appropriate to make that diversionary move and not a prosecution that would be on their record.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen,
the controlled substance would probably most likely be marijuana, pot, something like that.
Yes.
Is that, I mean, that's historically what you've been seeing where this would work?
Let's see if the language tells us.
It doesn't say.
Chapter 172.
Dan, do you know?
It's all fifth.
The language just says controlled substance, so it would be all low-level, low amount, low-level possession.
But Mr. Chair, of any...
Senator Rosen?
That's what it says.
Mr. Just one quick question,
Senator
maybe
Rosen.
For Ken. When we're talking about different quantities of controlled substance here, I guess I'm not finding that in here, or maybe that's a different part of the statute, but when we're talking about lower quantities and so on and so forth, I know there's certain guidelines and minimum mandatory sentences for possession of or dealing of controlled substance. Are we talking about anything like that at all here in this statute?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen,
Backus.
Section 1, you know, the deferred prosecution under 152.118 sub 1, it applies to fourth-degree possession offenses, fifth-degree possession offenses, and then a kind of a section called other controlled substance offenses, some of those provisions dealing with possession of various controlled substances. So I guess when people say lower-level drug offenses, I think they're referring to the fact that it's fourth-degree, fifth-degree, as opposed to, say, first-degree or second-degree possession. And then the way the current law is drafted, it basically is limited to people who don't have prior offenses.
There aren't any other questions. I'll move the A9 amendment. Did we ever figure out the funding piece of Section 1?
You have those? Mr. Turner?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members.
Mr. Turner, will you pull your microphone over close to you, please?
The appropriation for Section 1 was all for new staff. The superintendent said that approximately one and a half to two FTEs are associated with Section 1. If you take it at 1¾ at $63,000, an FTE comes to $110,000.
Okay. So it is not a no-cost section.
Madam, Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, that's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Since I don't think we have any money to spare, I think at this point we probably should take it out, even though I wish we could figure out a way to find what in the scheme of things is a pretty small amount of money around here anywhere.
Senator Higgins, is there a way to require the department to absorb the costs out of their general budget?
We can just say that. I'm not sure it's a very fair thing to do. I know it has been done over the years, but if they're saying that it's costing new staff, that's different than just saying, you know, there must be a couple of people around who can absorb this. So.
Well, your bill, Senator Higgins, so.
Mr. Chair, I think at this point we will leave 1.2 in the amendment. And I'll move that.
Okay, then Senator Higgins has moved the A9 amendment. Are there any further questions or discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the A9 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Amendment passes. Senator Higgins?
And then, Mr. Chair and members, I think I will direct your attention to sections 3.6 in the bill, section 3 through section 6. And this is something that we worked on the task force quite a bit, that would establish a certificate of good conduct for people who have been convicted, done their time in prison, and are now out, you know, having reentered the community, and that they have had no subsequent offenses. They have had a good record of a new life since they've gotten out, and that they then can go to court and petition to have this certificate of good conduct that would they then could go to an employer, to a landlord, to somebody to say, yes, I had this felony in my past, but I have come out of prison. I have been a good citizen since then, and I am deemed to be rehabilitated. In other states, they might call it a certificate of rehabilitation, and we decided that this certificate of good conduct was the way to go. And I know that the county attorneys testified in favor of this provision. If you look through these sections, you'll see kind of what the process of it is, what the contents of the petition are, you know, what the petitioner has to provide to the court, and specifies how the hearing takes place, who is eligible for this certificate of good conduct. That's on page 6. And how it is issued and what the effect of this certificate is on page 7. And it's a new concept, but I think it's one that really could be used by a lot of folks who have indeed turned their lives around and yet are seeing the collateral consequences of their action year after year after year after decade. So I'll ask Stan for questions on this piece, and then we need to talk about the financing of it.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, would a person who would be asking the court to issue this certificate of good conduct have to hire an attorney, or would they have to pay any cost to the court to get this to happen for them?
The fiscal note, we set up the filing fee as $240. The fiscal note then says that they would assume that about half of the people filing this would file in forma pauperis. Is that the right phrase? Where that fee could be waived. But part of why I didn't delete this out of the bill so far is that if we actually required that everybody did pay this, we could actually pay for the fiscal note, the court's cost in the fiscal note for doing this provision.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, the reason I'm asking the question is because most of my constituents don't know that you can ask to have a fee waived.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me like, you know, maybe that's not so bad when you're in court, you know, maybe not through any initiation of your own, because they have to inform you. But in this case, this would have to be initiated by the person that had the criminal history. And so I'm just kind of wondering how much this $240 is going to really provide kind of a chilling effect on people asking for, going through with this.
Well, that's why the bill, as it's written, does provide for them to ask for the fee to be waived. I've never gone through this. I don't know whether somebody at court would actually say that that is an option to them.
You have to get there first. Well, that's my concern. You have to get there, and this would be initiated by the person that has the previous criminal history. Most of my constituents who are in this situation, they do not have a relationship with an attorney on a daily basis. So they're not going to be given legal advice about the fact that they could file and not have to pay the fee. If the word out on the street is you can do this, but you've got to have $240, a lot of my constituents are going to say, well, I can't do that. I don't have $240. And then they go down to show up. And nobody's going to, tell them about it. I mean, maybe there's nothing we can do about that, particularly in this year, but I do think that it certainly will limit the effectiveness of this tool.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, the same could be said about when they file for an expungement of their record. I believe that there is that option as well, and if they realize that this record is getting in the way of a job and a place to live and moving on with their lives, there probably is that option to do the informa thing in that process as well.
Right.
At some point they're just going to have to make the first step.
I think very few of my constituents actually ever go ask to have their records expunged. I mean, by the time you get to that point, you have to demonstrate so much in terms of having had a job, da-da-da-da-da. You know, it's like, okay, so what is this going to do for me, really? I mean, I've had a job. I'm, managing it along. So they just don't go do it.
Well,
and, of course, you're trying to do this earlier in the process. I understand that. I'm not trying to criticize what you're trying to do here. I'm just worried that it's not going to actually, there's not very many people that are going to actually use it because of the financial barrier.
Senator Higgins?
At this point, I don't know that there's anything we can do about that. I think it could be an effective tool for a lot of folks who are ready to turn their lives around and have demonstrated that they're, in fact, going to stay on the straight and narrow, but that their record gets in the way. And at a certain point, if it is a tool that they feel can be useful to them, then I think they have to affirmatively go take that step to get there. And I would imagine that when people are going through their probation period, their parole period, maybe there will be conversations that can be held with their caseworker to say, this is available to you down the line if you don't reoffend, if you can get it together and become a good citizen. So if they're thinking that that is something that will help them, maybe they can put $5 away a month, and then by the time they're eligible for it, maybe some money will be there. And, of course, it's really hard to say that, if every $5 really matters. And I think when you're going to be getting jobs at the level that some of these folks get when they're coming out, those $5 will matter. But it's a tool that we're hoping that people can take advantage of. And I don't think that we can just say it can be free to everybody. I just don't think we can do that. In fact, the courts have told us that it's got a cost. So we do have to ask them to pay a fee. And I hope it works. I hope that people do figure out how to make it work.
Senator Moore.
John?
Well, Mr. Chair, and just on the note of this discussion, I think that Senator Berglund is correct in that. I appreciate the direction we're moving in terms of trying to productively address the collateral sanctions. And at some point, once we start to move in the direction of looking at some realistic tools to have them available, I think that we do have to think about a public service type of campaign to let people know about the tools that are available to them, because I think that your average constituent, my average constituent, once they're in a situation where they are so beaten down, they're not going to think about affirmatively that they can do these things. To the extent that this would be helpful, I think it will help the people who are actively looking for a job or trying to get a license as a real estate agent or something that requires licensing, and you know, or they're done. I think that in the collateral sanctions work group that this committee funded, I mean, there was conversations about people who would pay $5,000-$10,000 to get an associate degree in a particular trade, and then they come out and they find that they're collaterally barred from going into that job. Yeah. And I think this would help a lot to address that situation. Mm-hmm. I think to the extent that some of them could go and find that they could maybe establish or rehabilitate their record, I think that it could help. It doesn't solve the whole problem, but it could be yet another tool that could be helpful. So I think that while it costs money, I think it's a positive direction to move in, and we should continue to work on it.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I have. Senator Higgins, on line 631 there on page 6, when you talk about predatory offenders, 5 years, most of your, like, level threes, I believe, that finally are released are under intensive supervision. Would that 5 years then be limit kick in at the end of that supervision, or how would that work?
Mr. Backus, do you happen to know?
I think that supervision could be a very lengthy supervision once they're released.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Senator Ingebrigtsen. I haven't had a chance to review the bill really before, you know, the policy elements of the bill before the hearing. On line 6.24 to 2.6, been successfully discharged from the sentence imposed, that would certainly be, or not into correctional supervision, that would include either the last one-third served after prison in the community or the entire length of the probation. So that is a lengthy period depending on the initial sentence from the date of the crime. And then you have the clause 3, the law-abiding period, as well, that you have to, you know, before the actual petition.
So, Mr. Backus, if I understood you correctly, if you are still under registration or if you are still under intensive supervised release, you would then not qualify because of the phrase that it says if you are not under correctional supervision.
Yeah, Madam
Chair. Is that correct?
Yeah, you cannot apply if you're currently under correctional supervision or if you're currently required to register as a predatory offender. That's under clauses 1 and 2.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair. So the question then, I guess, would remain, once this person is off of this intensive supervision, they have to wait a 5-year period before they qualify? Or am I wrong?
That's right.
I don't think that's correct. I have to, you know, again, it's been a little bit since I reviewed this, but I think they work independently, that you have to be, that I think that the clock can be ticking at the same time, that you have to be
once they're released
law-abiding for the period that's specified in Clause 3, and you have to be discharged, so that if you're discharged from probation or correctional supervision and you've also met Clause 3, that you'd be eligible at that point. But let me review that.
Thanks.
towards it.
That's, way
that's what you thought as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my memory.
Any other questions or comments?
So, Mr. Kingray, or excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Kingray, did you want to talk about that one piece before I go on to the money piece?
The evidence.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the division, my name is John Kingray, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. The one comment that I wanted to make with regard to the Certificate of Good Conduct is the standard of proof is preponderance of the evidence. When this draft first came out, it was clear and convincing, and we recommended to both the House and Senate authors that be lowered so it's easier for individuals to prove their case in order to get a certificate of good conduct. We think that'll be an easier route for individuals to go to rather than the expungement route, which has a higher burden of proof. And my understanding is in filing for an expungement, there's a fee associated with that, too, that's either equal to this or greater.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if you'll look at the fiscal note, the section on the Supreme Court, it's hard to figure out, I think, anyway, which part of this fiscal note actually deals with the certificate. And I believe there's somebody here from the courts who we asked to come and whose name I can't remember.
Judy Rehack.
Say it again, please.
Judy Rehack.
Okay. Yes. And that would be her right there. Okay. Hello. If you could tell us, please, what piece of this fiscal note has to do specifically with the certificate, that would be great.
Ms. Rehack? Welcome.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judy Rehack. I'm a member of the State Court Administrator's Office and the coordinator of fiscal notes for the courts. Basically, the entire fiscal note cost attributable to the Supreme Court portion deals with the certificate of good conduct. So all of the costs shown on our part have been attributed to the certificate of good conduct. And the reason for those costs have to do with our concern about the number of persons who would initially apply for these certificates. Because it's a backward-looking opportunity, our assumption is that presumably a lot of people from the past who are interested in clearing up their good standing or their reputation in the community, their legal liabilities attributable to their sentences, will come forward, especially in the first few years as this opportunity is available to them, and apply for these certificates of good conduct. At some point in time, assuming that word gets out to the community through probation officers or through a more routinized notice of the availability of this procedure, that flow would even out. But when it's first available, we would anticipate that there would be a number of people from prior years coming forward and applying for these certificates of good conduct. We've estimated that a hearing might take 30 minutes. It might take longer if there are victims who come forward and want to testify. It might take shorter if nobody comes forward to oppose the granting of this petition. But on average, it might be about a 30-minute hearing. And if we assume, because of this balloon effect initially, that we might receive about 10,000 cases for the first couple years, that is what translates into the four judge units that have been predicted in the fiscal note here.
Chairman, I think.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Foley.
Sorry?
Senator Higgins, did you?
Mr. Chair, I, you know, since this is the second half of the biennium, I think that this is really quite extraordinary costs for something that will take effect three quarters of the way through the biennium. And I really challenge that this could actually cost this much money. And what I would like to suggest is that we dedicate the fees that come in through this to the cost to the courts, and that will be how much money it costs. And in 28 new staff and a couple of million dollars for something that really won't get going for quite some time, and it will take quite some time as well to get people to know that this option is available. And I think the effect on this biennium is actually going to be quite minimal. And so my suggestion to the committee is that the revenue that would come in would be sent to the courts, and then we're going to call it even. That's what they're going to get.
Is there a trying to read through the fiscal note here? Is there an estimate of the revenue that's coming in?
That would come in. Are these just regular civil filing or filing fees under the regular
filing? We'll pay.
Assuming half will pay and half will be in form of pauperous. And then, so that's the $250 filing fee that we're talking about. Is it separately specified?
Mr. Chairman, members, it's a $240,000 filing fee at $240,000. At 10,000 petitioners, you know, that's $2,400,000. If half of them file in forma pauperis, the revenue is estimated at $1,200,000 for in this fiscal note. And that's what Senator Higgins is saying would be then dedicated to the, to general district court funding, because we, of course, it says four judge units, but that's just an index. What's really going to happen is just, you know, we're creating a new court action, and, you know, we can't create another judge. I mean, judge units are created statutorily, and then they're tucked into they've got to belong in one of the 10 districts. So the money would flow towards general operating dollars for the district courts, is what I would gather. Is that correct?
That's what I was thinking, Mr. Turner, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley.
And Mr. Reyes, where's this bill go after it passes out of here?
Finance. Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, it goes to full finance. So.
We're going to have to go to your committee.
No. I think you're correct on that. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Turner,
Foley.
So we're talking about full finance out of this, after this bill. Is that
correct?
Okay. I would move that this bill be that'll be sent to the full finance committee for further action rather than take any kind of position here.
I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
I say rather than take any kind of condition here, that I would move that the 2790 be sent to the finance committee without recommendation.
All right, we have a motion on the table. Might have more discussion before.
Mr. Chair, I know that there are some more amendments that we want to look at before we do that.
Senator Higgins, a question for Ms. Rehak on the fiscal note. Is it broken down in any way, your fiscal note, by which judicial district it's expected that any proportion of these would arise out of? Would you be expecting that half of the certificates of good standing would come out of the 4th Judicial District, for example, or one quarter of them out of the 2nd Judicial District, or if you were to look statewide in the greater Minnesota Judicial Districts, what this looks like?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, the formula is applied across the board without an attempt to break it down by judicial district, but to the extent that the caseloads from particular judicial districts are a proportion of the state business, it might be possible to go back and line something out like that. Certainly, we would expect that a significant number, I don't know if it would be half, but something around half might come out of Hennepin County, maybe a third, something slightly smaller out of Ramsey County, then proportionately from the other judicial districts. But I have not attempted to do that in this fiscal note.
Ms. Rehak, you don't have any idea. I assume the courts have some data available, broken down by judicial district, what proportion of the kind of cases that would be eligible or convictions that would be eligible for this process arise out of each judicial district. Do you not?
We do. I don't have it with me available right now. But my understanding is, other than the predatory sex offenders who are specifically excluded, almost everybody else is eligible for this, at least for consideration for this certificate of good conduct. And then you'd have to look at the individual records of the individual defendants to see how they line up against the criteria that are called out in the bill.
And Ms. Rehak, do you have any idea what proportion of all cases then in the state are out of the 4th Judicial District?
62%.
I'm thinking it's between a third and a half, but I can certainly check and get back to you with that information.
You know, I'm asking the question for a specific reason, as you might gather, because there are different districts in Minnesota that are more efficient than others and that have developed the ability to find more efficiencies in their processes. I've gone to a greater Minnesota district courts where I wait around for an hour or so. A judge can hear a speeding ticket plea. Not a court trial, but a plea. Whereas in Hennepin County, you'd never get past a hearing officer in most cases unless you want the court trial. You'd never get in front of a judge. I mean, it's just they run far more efficiently in Hennepin County, in the 4th Judicial District, than they do in a lot of greater Minnesota judicial districts. Which says two things. One is, I think Hennepin County has found a way to be far more efficient in their processes, and so maybe they've got the ability to find additional efficiencies. I know they're working on it because they're dealing with significant potential cuts now, but it's also to say that maybe they're a little tighter in their efficiency, would have less ability to absorb stuff. But there's a lot of creativity in the courts right now trying to find efficiencies, but certainly to the extent that if you've got two-thirds statewide of these cases that might be arising in districts other than the 4th and the 2nd Judicial District, I think there are a lot of efficiencies to be found where they can absorb, they can find a way to do this without feeling they've got to add another judge to take care of it. But I don't see any recognition of that within the fiscal note. So that's why I'm asking the question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, it is correct that we are looking statewide at efficiencies. We're trying to do that continuously and recognize both a need and an obligation to do that in the public good. I would say that also over the years there have been discussions about the point at which speed and efficiency start to sacrifice justice. And so faster and shorter is not always better. And so we're trying to to figure out where that balance point is. There is some discussion about whether our metro courts have been pushed past the level where people are being accorded the full measure of justice that they deserve, because the cases have to be processed so quickly. The prediction of four judge units certainly would not in any way, shape, or form allow for an additional judge in each judicial district. And so were we to be granted any additional judges, we have a process where we rank our judicial districts in terms of their relative need, and the judicial district which demonstrates the greatest relative need would be the first district that got a new judgeship.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins, I know you had others wanted to testify on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I think at this point I'm going to suggest that we take this provision out of the bill, and when we send it to full finance, we will keep working on trying to figure out the pieces of it so that when it goes to finance, then if we can figure out the funding and all of that, I can bring it back, that certificate. I just think this is a wonderful opportunity for people, but I can see that it's not quite ready for prime time yet. So we have an A.
Madam Chair,
for a minute to delete the good conduct certificate at this point.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Foley,
I would withdraw my motion if you're willing to complete your presentation. I guess.
Oh, sorry, I forgot about that, Senator Foley. Thank you.
Senator Foley withdraws his motion.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, the A4 amendment deletes the three sections related to the Certificate of Good Conduct. I do that with great reluctance, but at this point I think it's the sensible thing to do.
Senator Higgins offers the A4 amendment. I would just encourage you, Senator Higgins, to continue to work on your creative thoughts about dedicating the fees to help pay for that particular advantage. I suspect even though fees are difficult for folks to come up with, there might be sufficient advantage if they could find the money that they might be willing to pay for the benefit themselves if the state isn't in a position to pay for it. So maybe this is a way to find some.
And thank you all for your discussion on this. It was really useful for us to try to figure out what to do. So I'll move the A4 amendment.
Any discussion on the A4 amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Okay, then, Mr. Chair, I have the A7 amendment, and then I think I'm through with amendments. I believe there's a handout that goes with this as well. Mr. Chair, last interim, there was a really good working group that got together down at the Veterans Administration office to look at the issues about when active duty or reservists come home from the military and then get in trouble with the law. And much of the same discussion went on as we had with the reentry folks, about you really mess up your chance for getting a decent job, a place to live, and all of that when you've got some sort of a conviction on your record. So we put together a bill that was really broad and quite wonderful, but it also had some problems in it. So everybody who was interested in the issue seemed to get together and spend a lot of time trying to figure out what we actually could do. And the A7 amendment is the result of that discussion. And it would, Senator Foley will find this, he's heard this before. But when a defendant is convicted of a crime, the court will be required to inquire whether the defendant is serving in the military or is a veteran. And if the defendant says yes and has been diagnosed with a mental illness that would include but not be limited to post-traumatic stress disorder, which we're finding out more and more and more is something that happens when folks come back from
from their military duty, then the court may order that the officer preparing the report find out what treatment is available and get that information back to the court. The judge then is allowed to consider the treatment recommendations in imposing the sentence. And I have with me Dan Knuth, and he was part of the working group that started last interim and then was putting together this language before you. And I would like to ask him to add anything he'd like to add.
Mr. Knuth?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Higgins has covered this quite well. I'd like, in the handout, like to make one change. The handout is for House File 3902, Article 2. It's actually Article 3. So if you look for this in the, it's in the Ag and Veterans Affairs omnibus bill in the House. But this bill does several things. One, and the primary reason we're doing this is to open up communications between the courts and Veterans Affairs to assure that sentencing is handled correctly for people who are suffering from mental illness and as a result of their active duty in the military. As you're well aware, there are more and more veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who come back to their community and display behaviors that are not normal from what their behaviors were before. And they may be suffering from PTSD. Unfortunately, that members of the military have a warrior culture, where they think that some of these concerns they may be feeling or may be having may be considered a weakness. So oftentimes they don't show these things don't show up until they've acted out and they end up in the court system. This bill is simply adds to the subdivision of Minnesota Statute 609.115 for pre-sentencing investigations. Once the individual has been found guilty or has pled guilty, the judge, the court will ask that if this person was a veteran, there's some apparently maybe some concerns with that. But then once that's determined, if there is indeed a psychological or a mental examination available, then the defendant, during the normal pre-sentence investigation held generally by a probation officer, will contact the Department of Veterans Affairs and including also the Veterans Administration to see what treatment options are available. Then the judge takes that into consideration before rendering a sentence, that the judge may veteran or currently serving member of the military get be as part of their sentence be sent to treatment, and then as they continue on in their probation, and there may be other things that may be required of them. Basically, it says the idea is that the veteran or person currently in the military would either complete treatment or go to jail or to go to prison. This bill is supported by the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the State Public Defender's Office, the Minnesota Association of County Attorneys. Hennepin County Attorney's Office worked very closely with this, and I have to thank David Brown from that office for doing the bulk of the drafting and to help us all reach a compromise to do that. He's available in the audience if there's any detailed questions. Also, the Department of Military Affairs is supporting it, the Minnesota National Guard, leadership of the American Legion, and also leadership of the Military Order of Purple Heart. So there was a fiscal note on this. We had lengthy discussions with the Department of Military Affairs, and they indicated that they could handle training for the probation officers who will be writing the pre-sentence investigations. They could be handling that under their potential training or potential workshops under their current existing budget. It's contemplated that various organizations such as the Bar Association and other entities, professional organizations, would invite the Department of Veterans Affairs to come in to talk about this bill, talk about the requirements of the bill, and to demonstrate what kinds of things that were available. It's difficult to talk to about a bill, something that it's not. This is simply not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It sets some very strong requirements. It leaves the discretion up to the judge as they would be dealing with any other pre-sentence investigation.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Higgins and Mr. Knuth, was this introduced as a bill?
Yes.
Yes, it was.
It was many pages, and it's been boiled down to this.
Where was this bill heard?
Senator Moi, this was sent to your division, and this was one of the bills that the agreement that was reached was reached about 5 minutes after you closed your last day's hearings requests, and so this is where this bill is being heard.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to sit on this committee and have a chance to look at this. So it's unfortunate that we didn't have an opportunity to look at it in full committee.
I agree.
We agree.
But sometimes compromise takes a little longer than, we were also telescoped into such a very short amount of time this year. And the folks who worked together trying to put this bill together did a wonderful job in seeing what the problem was and what the solutions might be, and it just took a little longer to compromise than what we had available. So I appreciate your indulgence in working through this with us. So
any other questions on the A7 amendment? All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion carries, amendments adopted.
And then, Mr. Chair, I believe Senator Moi has an amendment.
The same, Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, the A8 amendment. While the A8 amendment is being handed out, I'd like to give context to the A8 amendment. I had discussions with Senator Higgins about the A8 amendment. We're in a precarious situation where the A8 amendment is a bill that has passed through all the committees of the Senate, and it is now on the Senate floor. The other body had a different, maybe we're operating under a different timetable. And so they're giving this the companion of this bill a hearing in a subcommittee this week. And so in conversation with Senator Higgins, because the Senate has taken a position on this bill and think that it's a good bill and it's on the Senate floor, we wanted to create an opportunity to see if we can get some real work done on this bill. So Senator Higgins has indulged me to allow me to make this an amendment to her bill. It deals with collateral sanctions and reentry issues, so it's appropriate to go into the bill. And so I'd like to walk through the provisions of the A8 amendment. If you served on the Judiciary Committee, you've heard this bill. If you serve on the Business and Jobs and Industry Committee, you've heard this bill. Members, the A8 amendment let me back up a little bit. Under current law, under Minnesota statute section 364.04, that section of Minnesota law specifies that criminal records involving an arrest not followed by a conviction cannot be used by public employers for in connection with an application for public employment. And what the A8 amendment is trying to do is to extend that same ability to private employers. So if you would look at the crux of the bill, I want to direct you to page 2, lines 2.7 through 2.14, which basically says, you know, unless a criminal background investigation is specifically required or permitted by law, and I'll come back to talk about that part, a private employer must not request information regarding a non-conviction criminal record, and that's defined up above on line 2.1, from an employee or prospective employee, or obtain access to a non-conviction criminal record from another source, or take adverse action against an employee or prospective employee based on a non-conviction criminal record. And a non-conviction criminal record is defined, as I said, in line 2.1, and then a private employer is defined at line 2.4. But in an effort to be responsive to private employers, because we are asking them to not consider non-conviction records, we've created in different iterations an affirmative defense for employers. And so line 2.15 through line 2.25 provides, in previous iterations we call it a safe harbor, but really in consultation with people who do this kind of work, it really is more of an affirmative defense. And then there's a remedy that's provided in subdivision 4 line 2.26. The front page of the amendment, starting at line 1.4 through line 1.26, deletes a sunset provision on internet access to BCA records. I think that sunset was provided when initially internet access to the BCA records was first established, and we didn't quite know how it was going to be functioning. And so we're deleting the sunset provision to restore the internet access. And basically what it does is that it provides the right of job applicants to be notified when an employer uses the website to conduct a background check. And that is the gist of the amendment. Again, this is a bill that has passed through all the committees in the Senate. May deadline is sitting on the Senate floor. So I hope that I will have your support to put this on to Senator Higgins' bill.
Senator Moy offers the A8 amendment. Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, I'm fine with this amendment. Fits well with the bill.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Moy, I have a question. Non-conviction criminal record definition on top of page 2 refers to a record relating to a criminal proceeding that is not pending and did not result in a conviction. It seems from the terms that it would not cover a situation where a person was charged and there was an agreement to suspend prosecution on the charge for a period of time. Am I reading that the same way you understand it? Because it's quite common in certain jurisdictions for certain kinds of criminal charges for an agreement to be reached between the prosecutor and the defendant that prosecution would be suspended. The case would be continued for, say, a period of a year. And if at the end of that year there were no violations of the conditions of that continuance, then the matter is dismissed. During that time, there's no conviction, but there is a charge technically still pending.
And, Mr. Chair, I would read that it did not result in a conviction. I believe that those situations would be covered under non-conviction criminal record, but counsel could, differ. That's how I would interpret that.
Counsel?
Mr. Chair and members, if Senator Letts or Mr. Chair, if you are correct in that the action is still pending, then that might be a problem then. Because it has, if it's other records that's not pending and did not result. So if it's just one of the two, I think,
After a year has passed and the matter is dismissed because the conditions were met, there were no new offenses or whatever, they paid the prosecution costs, then it would clearly be
not pending and did not
But during that one-year window, technically the charge is still pending in the court system.
Yes, it would be pending.
It would be pending, so it would not qualify for this.
Correct. Vision. So it's an and test here, Mr. Chair. It would be not pending and did not result in a conviction.
So during that period of time, it could be used for background checks. It's only after that time has passed that it could not be used as background check.
It's an and test here, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Moore, on lines 211, the obtained access, what exactly does that mean? How would that work?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I believe that that's in reference to kind of third-party information or, you know, data harvesters. Information.
Newspaper.
That's not quite, I mean, not necessarily what I was contemplating, but I suppose that would fit. And Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to come back to line 2.8 when I said that I would come back to the information about investigation is specifically required, permitted by law. I know that people were concerned about in instances where we specifically allow by statute people to do background checks. Those private employers who are specifically asked by statute to do background checks are not covered under this. I mean, they can continue to do the background checks. So I just want to make sure. People are concerned about things like the bus driver background checks and things like that that we in statute specifically permit. In those instances, I mean, they continue to be covered under those background check requirements. So, Mr. Chair, if there are no further discussions, I'll renew my motion to move the A8 amendment.
Senator Moore, if I might ask a follow-up question to my earlier questions. And I don't know if even procedurally if there's any point in having a discussion about the substance or looking maybe to adjust it, but was it had you had some discussions about the particular kind of circumstance that I had raised and as to whether or not you intended to cover that kind of situation? I mean, when I think about a case that's pending initially, you know, it's pending when the charge has been brought, but it hasn't been resolved in court yet. Then you get to court and it's been resolved in court in a way in which prosecution is suspended, technically, I think, is still pending, but, you know, for the next year. Were you intending to cover that kind of situation or not to cover?
Mr. Chair, I would like to continue the conversation with you on this issue if the committee members will indulge us. When we brought this bill to the full Judiciary Committee as well as to the Jobs Committee, those specific issues were not raised. And so there was no discussions about those specific instances. And it may just be that many of us are not practitioners who have those specific scenarios in mind. I didn't think about some of those specific scenarios, so when I look at this, I see it as an and test. But I'll continue to have the conversation with you, and I'd like to bring in the people who helped me put together the bill to have conversations with you to make sure that we can answer your questions.
Okay. So then, Senator Moore, how would you like to proceed by adopting the A8 amendment now and then have the conversations today?
Yes. Okay. That would be okay, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Is there any further discussion about the A8 amendment?
Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair and Senator, what committees you said it passed through?
Went already? To the, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, it went to the Senate Judiciary Committee and it went to the Business, Jobs, Industry Committee.
Any further questions or discussion on the A8 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Chair is uncertain. Could I ask for a
roll call?
We'll do a roll call, division? I guess, or a division, I think, at this point. All those in favor, raise your right hand.
Your other right hand.
Okay, opposed, raise your right hand. Or raise a hand. But just one hand.
Raise your right hand.
Well, make it easy.
Okay, the acoustics from my position are apparently not very good. The motion carries. The amendment's adopted. Are there any further amendments to the bill?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any.
Any further discussion or witnesses, Senator Higgins?
No. It's a shadow of its former self, but those are the financial requirements that we are working under these days. And so thank you all for working on this bill with us today, and I'd like to move Senate File 2790 as amended.
I should ask if there are any members of the audience that would like to comment on the bill before we go to a vote on that. Seeing none. Senator Higgins has moved that this file be, Senate File 2790 be recommended to pass as amended and forwarded to the Finance, is going to finance Division from here. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you very
that's
much.
That's the last item on the agenda for today.
Oh, no. No, we have our budget.
I was anxious to get to dinner.
Let's take a show of hands on that.
Sorry.
Division?
Yeah.
All right. I will turn the chair back over to the chair.
Budget bill.
I saw you at the end. I thought we were done.
Okay, members, the last item on the agenda today is the thing that I'm sure everybody in the audience has been waiting for all day.
That's why they're leaving.
And you're all being so orderly, I think we'll start talking about it while you are standing in line to get copies of the spreadsheet and the article. It's not very big. And I think I'll have Mr. Turner walk through it for us. And the print's really, really, really small.
Do they have, I mean, is everybody, yeah.
They're waiting for the, that's why they're so orderly, is they don't have it yet,
yeah.
That's why.
I think we should.
Yeah, I think Alice is going that way, I think.
Okay. Madam Chair?
I think we're ready to go, Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, I'll be working off the spreadsheet that was just handed out. A note beforehand. The division was asked to come up with a net general fund cut of $11,888,000. And although the spreadsheet compares the Senate rec with the governor's rec, I'm not going to compare them individually, but to give you some idea, the governor's net cut was $4,950,000. So with the Senate coming in almost 2.5 times higher, it was a fairly difficult task that was asked of Senator Higgins. The way we did it was we cut the general fund by $9.9 million and then increased a general fund transfer from the fire safety account, a special revenue account that was created 2 years ago, by $1 million a year, $2 million total. So that comes to the net savings to the general fund of $11.9 million.
Now, we did this by only cutting three agencies, Department of Public Safety by $2.3 million, the Department of Human Rights by $112,000, and then, of course, because they're the agency with all the money in our division, the Department of Corrections by $7.9 million. And I'll just start going over line by line. I'll start on line two on the spreadsheet. We have a Homeland Security and Emergency. This is within the Department of Public Safety, which has a total net cut of $1,946,000. Of that, in Homeland Security and Emergency Management, we have a $36,000 general operating budget cut. The next line, line three, is the only appropriation in the bill, the only general fund appropriation. It's a deficiency for the 2006 Red River flood disaster. It's the state match for the FEMA funds. Line four, this is a governor's recommendation, saving $40,000 in chemical assessment team and hazmat team reimbursements. We would delete the $40,000 in the base for that, and then require reimbursement for the team's services by the companies who were responsible for the incidents. So that would come to a total cut in 2009 for Homeland Security of $76,000, and then we'd have the state match. So it's a net appropriation of $284,000. We move down to the BCA. We have a total bureau cut of $1,659,000. Of that, $659,000 would be a general operating reduction within the BCA itself. When I say general reductions, we intend that it would be up to the we give complete discretion to the agency to how they would like to cut that. When we decide a cut, it has its own line, as in the next line, the CRIMNET base cut of $1 million. Move to gambling and alcohol enforcement operating reduction of $24,000. Then the Office of Justice Programs, we have an operating reduction of $547,000. We did not agree with the governor's crime victim service grant cut or financial crimes task force. However, it would be within OJP's discretion, the commissioner's discretion, to cut whatever he wanted out of the base. Then we move on to the Department of Human Rights. We have a general operating reduction of $112,000. Then we move to the Department of Corrections. We have a total cut of $7,880,000. Of that is an institution's operating reduction of $4,281,000. A community services operating reduction of $1,568,000. Then we have two governor's recommendations. Short-term offender grants, the governor was going to cut the entire increase from last year. The division recommendation, or the chairman's recommendation, is to have that and cut $1,250,000 from short-term offender grants. The next governor's rec was accepted, sentencing to service $600,000. And then we have an operations support division reduction of $181,000, with a total cut of $7,880,000. Next line is a special revenue line, the peace officer standards and training. There's an operations supplement. This is the result of a mistake that was made last year when we were putting together the bill. There was a spreadsheet error, and the total for the post board was incorrect. That is special revenue, but it's actually a cost of the general fund, because there's a transfer out of the general fund into the post board special revenue fund for that. So that costs $50,000. So then we have what we've got is a general fund cut, net cut of $9,938,000. General fund transfer from the fire safety account of $2 million, and the transfer out to the special revenue fund, the loss to the general fund from the post board of $50,000 for a total net cut of $11,888,000, which was the requested target. And Madam Chair, the bill itself is very simple and just reflects the spreadsheet. There's nothing in it. It's all reduction appropriations. Section 6 is the fire safety account, the general fund transfer. And Section 7 is the post board correction from last year. Just point out, though, that almost all of these are general reductions, and agencies have the discretion on cutting where they
can. Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chris, for the report. With regards to the Department of Human Rights, we talked about putting the department in St. Cloud, so that's going to be eliminated. Is that right?
The way I understand it, the department in St. Cloud is going to be funded by the city of St. Cloud and them getting other funds. So we didn't have to find money to do that program, which I was really pleased about.
And one follow-up question. Thank you for that. The short-term offender grants is going to go from basically $30 to $15 then? Does that sound right?
Per day? Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'd say they're at about $33 right now, and they'll go down to, we think, between 20 and 21.
Which is a far cry from the $9 we were doing last year.
Yes.
But still not what they say it costs them.
Thanks.
But
mm-hmm.
Senator Rosen, you have that look in your eye.
Yeah, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Turner, generally, there's been a 4% cut all across all agencies. How much is this cut to this particular? It's greater than 4%.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, actually, this is a 2% cut to their total base for public safety and the Department of Corrections. Everybody else got, within the Senate plan, a 4% cut. The courts and corrections and public safety got a 2% cut.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where is the drug courts? Where is that in?
That is in Senator Foley's division.
Oh.
Okay. Which we had a meeting about this afternoon.
Okay. No better. Thank you.
We come together for the conference committee because the House has basically Senator Foley's division and my division in one committee, but the courts are Senator Foley's bailiwick.
We don't have any money, so
that's
why we got a bigger cut than you did.
So any other questions on that? It's pretty straightforward. I do know that.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Is there any way that an explanation on the institution's operating reductions of the Department of Corrections could be clarified? Where that's coming out of, and what that means?
I just got a note asking if the department can come and talk to us about that, so we'll ask them. Commissioner Fabian?
Madam Chair, members, I'm not up here to whine, but I am up here to say that I appreciate you've been very supportive in the past, and I know that this isn't all in your area to cut, and you get your orders like we get our orders. And I just want to say, though, that the reason we didn't get cuts with the governor's budget is that we have been cut, you know, $80 million since 2000. We have no extra money, and I had sent out a flyer that showed that we're projecting a $10 million deficit. So with this additional seven, we will have to have a very large number of layoffs. It will definitely compromise the safety in our prisons, and it will compromise what our probation officers do out in the field as far as supervising offenders. So I just had to say that this isn't something that we can just suck up like in other years we've been able to do it. We're real concerned about how we even do what we have now. And then to have this big a cut will definitely compromise public safety. And I really felt I needed to say that.
Thank you. Commissioner, I know Senator Rosen wanted to know the institution's cuts line. Tell us kind of what kind of cuts. I know you just saw this spreadsheet
right.
when everybody
right.
else did, but what kinds of cuts do you imagine?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we would have to look at cuts in our CD treatment area, probably education. I would not be cutting the security officers because we really don't have enough of those as it is. So it would be programming within the prison. But then, you know, that also helps us keep down the number of security officers that we have but with the programming. So that would be the only place I could see cutting.
Well, thank you for coming to talk to us. You know, the division chairs have had several meetings together, and we were all in a position of advocating for the departments that are in our divisions. And we, you know, Senator Berglund's there trying to figure out how to not cut nursing homes and not cut, you know, vulnerable adults and, you know, children with disabilities and all those kinds of things. And I was there with saying, you know, do you want me just to open up a prison? And that wasn't well received either. but, you know, we have $1 billion we have to cut out of the budget, and we have no good choices. And so, you know, this is I sat in Senator Foley's committee today, and the courts got cut. And that's the only thing in Senator Foley's division. And so they got a big cut. As well, and then Mr. Turner, of course, told us that we got the small cuts in our divisions, and the other divisions are looking at some very very big cuts. And so, I don't think it's going to be pleasant working through the rest of this budget.
Madam Chair, and I do know that last time too that you know this group very much advocated for us to get the money that we needed, and I. You know, part of this is just to tell you how much I appreciate that, and you really have. But the other part is, you know, I really do keep a real tight budget. And, you know, I know that this is not something that we can just you know, take. So,
okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, and maybe Mr. Turner could figure out how much the Department of Corrections, what percent they are absorbing in the total bill, what their percent cut is in the Department of Corrections. Thank you.
If you look, Senator Rosen, on the base fiscal year 09 column, you'll see what their budgets are compared with everyone else. And they're at about, give or take, $500 million. Where everybody else is under $45 million. So they are the big piece of our budget. So,
Senator Turner.
And Senator Rosen, 66% is corrections portion in within this division bill.
All right. Anybody else want to come talk to us? Mr. Tuma.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Tuma. I'm with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Just a little confusion for us, though, from the counties. We appreciate, first of all, your willingness to backfill in some of the cuts the governor gave us in short-term offenders. That's critical. It goes right to the bottom line of your property taxpayers and your community. So thank you. I guess the question I have is for on page 3.8, or actually line 3.8 of your language, you have a $1.568 million cut in the community service area. These are all pass-through grants to counties. Typically, they're your community corrections and your CPO and grants. We're just unclear what's your intent with those cuts. Is that something that you leave up to the department to cut the pass-through grants, or is this money cut out of administration? So I guess we just wanted clarity what your intent was.
Madam Chair, members.
Mr. Turner.
The way the bill's written right now, they can take it from any part of the community services budget. They could take it from the CCA subsidy. They could take it from the CPO. They could take it from various grant programs. They've got complete discretion as the bill's written right now.
They could take that also, Madam Chair and Mr. Turner. I won't demote you to Senator. But that would also... that would also be like...
take it all back. Don't
yeah.
House member.
Yeah.
Council member?
House member. Member, yeah.
House member, oh, that's right.
We're a little slow, you know. They could also take that from the SDO grants, those type of things, too, then.
Okay. Yes.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tuma. Anybody else want to talk to us?
Thank you for doing a good job.
Sure. Would you move the spreadsheet and the language, somebody?
I would.
Can we vote on them both at the same time? I think we can. Senator Foley moves the Article 17 and the companion spreadsheet. Any further discussion? All in favor of Senator Foley's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. Thank you all very much. We are adjourned.